Blog Talk Radio.
It's not just Washington that is broken. It's America who is asleep at the wheel. Why do they tell us that the Constitution is outdated? Can you outdate liberty? This is Brett Rappaport, and you are listening to the Final Say Radio Show.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to the Final Say Radio Show. Happy Tuesday. Of course, you know what Tuesday means. It means that our good friend James S. Robbins will be joining us a little bit later in the program. And of course, if you're reading the USA Today or the many other periodicals that he often writes for, you'll see his article almost immediately after the speech by Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister. And of course, we're not going to get into it right now. We'll save it for Jim. We'll get into the weeds with Jim, as we say. There's other things going on. First of all, John, one of the most important things going on, because as I've discovered, the average American really doesn't care about most of what we talk about, which would explain why we're in the position we are in today, have the president that we have today. But what we really should be focused on is which NFL players receive the franchise tag, meaning they get paid in the top 3, 4, or 5 salaries at their position, and they basically get a boatload of money to stay with the team for one more year in hopes that they can sign a long-term deal or just let them go. So I'm at least happy that the Giants have somehow come up with the $14 million to retain Jean-Pierre Paul, their wonderful defensive end, who quite honestly, is probably as equally good against the run as he is against taking down the quarterback. Why are we talking about this? Well, why not? I mean, it's important, John. I mean, the Grammys were important. The cartoons on your cereal box. This is important stuff, John. It's very important. And well, I'm being cynical. I'm being cynical for a reason, and I'll let you jump in. But one of my sons, I have 3 children, of course. One of my sons didn't read a chapter in his history book and didn't do so well on his quiz. Guess which son? Anyway, I picked up his book and I started asking him questions and then eventually just decided to teach him his history book because the school system's failing him. It doesn't matter how many billions or trillions we spend on education. It's still like a failed school system. You look at the textbook, by the way. It's almost a joke. I mean, he was on chapter 8. Chapter 8's maybe 10 or 15 pages. Could you imagine in a textbook, John, like a 15-page chapter? And could you imagine, I mean, my guess is they probably take a week or two to go over that. So I don't even want to get into the length of time it takes to go over minimal amount of material. But it's big words, lots of pictures, very little information, very little detail. And it's shocking to me that first this is how we teach history. And it's also shocking to me that the kids just aren't learning it. And I just say the system's a failure. And I bring this up for a specific reason, and you'll understand why I'm doing this, John. We've all heard the saying, many people, I forget who originally said it, but, you know, those who don't study their history are doomed to repeat it. And quite frankly, I would say that even those who studied history, if you don't learn from history, you're going to repeat it as well. It's kind of like you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. But the bottom line is, it's like this federal government that James Madison and Thomas Jefferson argued against, you know, the strong central government. They were right. I mean, it's a long time ago, but they were right. Because all this massive federal government has done is figure out ways to keep enough of the population on drugs and alcohol and undereducated and underemployed and dependent upon whatever they can give them just enough to keep them in the game and to keep themselves in office to continue to do whatever it is that they are doing for their own interest. And you want to throw out an interest, I'll throw out Hillary Clinton, and then I'll let you comment. Hillary Clinton, two things there, because it all, I mean, you talk about in your own interest. Why was she using her personal email accounts? And this isn't the first person in this administration. There are numerous other people, some of which have actually gone down, some of which should be in jail, but sat before Congress all too many times trying to explain themselves, have used personal email accounts. The president himself uses his personal BlackBerry, so God knows what he's said and who's, he's, you know, what communist or socialist or fascist or one of our enemies that he's communicated with that we don't have proper records of. But Hillary Clinton, John, first it's her foundation taking money from foreigners as she's negotiating on behalf of the United States foreign policy, and now using a personal email. First of all, she's too old. Her policies are horrible. She was never very good to begin with. I don't think she's qualified to be president, so I don't know why she'd run anyway. But then again, as I said, we've set this stage. There's enough Americans who have their head buried very deep in the sand that allow for this thing to happen. But I honestly think that she's got a serious amount of trouble here. Don't be surprised if Moonbeam or from California or Biden or Elizabeth Warren, one of those three, will be the candidate running against someone in the GOP. Go ahead, John.
Well, clearly there has to be a better candidate than Hillary for numerous reasons. I don't even want to go into the normal ones that, because I've covered it for anybody who's listened to the final say, they've heard me cover it many times. But at a minimum, we have the single greatest high-risk time probably since, if you really want to look honestly, since World War II, probably since the standoff between Kennedy and Khrushchev over the missile crisis, which literally had American and Soviet warships going nose to nose until the Khrushchev backed down. I'm not sure we've been at a more dangerous point in time. It's that simple. And it's almost entirely due to massive foreign policy failures, partly due to ineptness, partly due to this radical sub-border sovereignty busting mentality that the president has, where he's trying to redistribute American power, American prosperity, American sovereignty, American money, everything around the world. He's not just doing this within. He's not just trying to take from the workers and give to the takers. He's doing it worldwide. But you got to remember, this is not just Obama. Hillary was the Secretary of State, I believe the most traveled Secretary of State of all times from a mileage perspective. Hillary had lots of signature efforts like the Russian Reset. And pretty much, I'm not sure of any that were even a moderate success. There's probably some tropical island somewhere that we helped plant a couple of palm trees, you know, maybe some disaster recovery efforts. But in every meaningful way,
she has one success.
You found a success?
Somewhere in the Pacific, John, that little tiny country, Burma.
It could be. It could be. Yeah, I know.
Myanmar, Burma, whatever we're calling it these days.
Now.
That's it. Seriously. That is her biggest claim to fame.
I believe you're right, actually. But so I think that she would be decimated by anybody. And unless, of course, you know, the people are insane enough to have Mitt Romney run again, because I'm not so sure Mitt Romney wouldn't make the same mistake twice, especially against a woman. We need somebody who comes across as being sober, fair, honest, reflective, and very, very cool. And by the way, you know, we didn't get a chance to do, we've been very busy in fundraising mode for our business, so we've done a few repeats lately, but so CPAC, some of those speeches, you saw a couple of great candidates. Forget what the straw polls say. If you look at the straw polls, you would say it's going to be a Rand Paul win. Well, no, it's not. Rand Paul may do well at CPAC. He would not do well in a general election. And the last thing we need in a time where the world is falling apart is an isolationist. If there's one thing that could potentially be even riskier than somebody who pretty much just lays down on the tracks, it would, you know, an isolationist, you know, could be even riskier because then you have a false sense of security. But I want to go back to
John, do you mind? When you're done, remind me to pick up on your isolationist thought there.
Okay, well, we'll come back to isolationism. But so there were a handful of people. If you listen to Governor Jindal talk, brilliant, calm, cool, collective. You could say the same thing. And with a lot of experience, and he took an absolute, you know, miserable state with all the same kind of failings you have in Chicago politics and has really done a great job of managing it and helping to turn it around. You could say the same for Governor Scott Walker, also very cool cat, handles himself well under fire, and he's been under fire like nobody. Then you also have, of course, one of my personal favorites, Ben Carson, because he's not a politician. Because Ben Carson is a self-made man who knows what it's like to come from nothing and build something, and he also knows what it's like not only to build a professional career to the highest level, but also to give back to the community. And he handles himself with such a calm, cool grace and dignity that I think it would absolutely be the perfect follow-up to a divider-in-chief. Speaking of dividers, we're going to talk primarily about Netanyahu's speech later in the show, but I wanted to follow. There's one very specific thing I wanted to point out. I want to give some great praise to Harry Reid, former majority leader of the Senate, because I thought Harry actually handled himself with a lot of dignity. You know, we slam him a lot, but you got to give credit where credit's due. He was very gracious. He was quick to stand, even though he's not physically still recovering. And I actually give him a lot of credit. On the flip side, sitting very close to him, you had Senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, and I thought she had a look on her face and she actually looked around. If you watch, she kept looking around at others to see when it was when she had to stand up to applause. She could, you know, it was like, I'm glad she showed up. But if you show up, you might actually want to be there. It was a bit disrespectful. However, completely overshadowed by Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi acted like a high school nitwit. Nancy Pelosi kept turning around, especially during applauses. She kept turning around, and she had this nasty look of disdain on her face talking to, trying to remember who she was talking to behind her, but one of the other Democratic leaders. And she had this scowl and this nastiness on her face that she was so disgusted that BB was setting up.
Debbie Wasserman Schultz, was it?
Debbie was much, from most of what I could see in camera angles, give it to Debbie too. Normally very caustic, she seemed pretty well behaved. However, I was looking at Pelosi's face and I was thinking, that woman looks as ticked off as Hillary Clinton if she found in Bill's cigar humidor.
You know, she can't help that, though, John. She's had so many facial surgeries. I mean, give her a break there, would you? She can't help
anyway.
John,
what is Dianne Feinstein?
No, I don't want to go there at the moment. Dianne Feinstein, by the way, you think about the powerful position she has in the Senate Arms Finance Committee, basically in charge of, or one of the most important people in charge of the nation's national security from the Senate standpoint. And she's scary. I mean, it's scary what the Democratic Party has become. It's even scarier the people that they've placed in these positions of power. So if I can, you mentioned so many things there that were, you know, just things I've heard or follow up on. Alan Combs, who was on, I believe it was the IMUS program like a day or so ago. I'm pretty sure that's where this was. And they were talking about Scott Walker And what's interesting, Scott Walker is trying not to get caught up in the middle of these gotcha questions. And you can't blame a person. I mean, the media today doesn't want to discuss the issues. They don't want to really hear where people stand on policy and things of that nature. They want to just, you know, catch somebody saying something a little bit nutty or off the wall and make that the biggest deal of a campaign. And it's unfortunate because, well, you end up with a bunch of whack-a-moles in positions of power when you refuse to actually adequately debate and discuss the issues. So Scott Walker is basically trying to avoid making the comment of whether he thinks the president is really anti-American or whatever the actual question was exactly. So Alan Combs is sitting here calling out Scott Walker, saying he's not qualified to be president because he won't answer questions. He won't answer. He skirts the questions. I wish I was on that show, and it's shame on the entire staff for no one even going to Alan Combs and saying, hey, Alan, schmuck, what about the current president who not only doesn't answer questions or his press secretaries, but they outright lie and talk about things that have nothing to do with what you're actually asking, instead of just politely saying, as Scott Walker did, I'm going to skip that one. You know, I'm calling the BS out on Alan Combs and frankly, all these Democrats, because it's the same old, same old. It's like when Bush was president, he could do no right. Obama's president, well, the reason that he could hardly do any right is his policies. It's the policies. It's his decisions. It's his unqualified stature. It's him. Okay? Bush was qualified to do some of the things he was doing. Obviously, some things he was over his head, or some things he made poor choices on. We call him out on it, by the way. Alan Combs. Scott Walker is trying to talk about some of the important issues, okay? And quite frankly, he said it himself, I'm not concerned with what Obama thinks of the country. I'm concerned with what I think of the country and what the American people think of the country. I tip my hat to you, Scott Walker. By the way, John and I met him we met him a few times, but several years ago we actually spent some time with him and have some great photos of us. We'll have to put those up. Right now I continue to, on Facebook at least, to have my picture of Alan West, who we've also met with and have spent a lot of time with him. But he's one of my favorites. But Scott Walker's a good guy. I like him. I'm not saying he should be the overall pick, but he's a good guy. So one more thing going back a little bit further, John, the isolationism. I can understand the point because – quite frankly, we end up, because of politics and because of the media, making such poor decisions so many times with regards to foreign policy. It's kind of like you go to war in Vietnam, and instead of winning the war as quickly as you can and fighting it the way you did World War II, the politics and the people get involved, and you start listening to what the news anchors are saying instead of what your best and brightest advisors say and actually what's going on the ground and pay attention and act accordingly. And then you end up losing these wars. And so isolationism could make sense for that matter. But when you go back to the origins of isolationism, John, again, you're going back to, you know, our most famous of founders, the gentleman who started this country. But they had a very good point for not wanting to get involved in foreign affairs. And think about this. You just finished a war with a country where most of your people came from, with Britain, the Revolutionary War I'm talking about. And so you still have these ongoing skirmishes between Britain and France and Spain and this. And I mean, there were a lot of old empires still battling out. And we made a decision to say, we don't want to get in the middle of this because we really don't have anything to gain by being, you know, pissing off both sides, if you will. And that's essentially what you end up doing. So better to try to stay out of it, better to try to deal with your country, a new country that's very unstable, and get that sound footing. And that's what we did. And so this country experienced a period of about 100 years of isolationism. But the world changed. The world's always been global. So let's not, you know, pretend like globalization's a new thing. There's always been global trade. There's always been global conquest. We could sit here and talk about that. We don't have enough time today. But, John, isolationism as a policy makes sense when it's appropriate. But as an overall policy, it doesn't make sense because you have to look at each individual circumstance. For example, if you have a civil war going on in some country in the middle of Africa that we really have no foreign policy, national security interest, or business dealings with, do we want to get involved in that? So then the next fallback would say, is there a human interest here? In other words, is there acts of genocide or things going on that maybe, not us as a country, but maybe international bodies need to get involved in? Okay. But then you have something that you're directly involved in, Iran. We can name a bunch, but Egypt, one of our allies, Libya. You know, when do you get involved? When don't you get involved in? And I could argue we've made a lot of mistakes here, but that's not the point. You can't just close your eyes and say, let the civil war happen in Syria, and we'll wait until it's done to see how things fall. Well, John, and this will be a very lengthy part of the conversation, I'm sure, with Jim. One of the biggest failures right now is we are allowing Iran to take over countries, whether it's by proxy or otherwise, one at a time. We can name four right now. It's only a matter of time before there's many more. What does this lead to? What's the president's answer? Did you see his response to Benjamin Netanyahu's speech? Priceless. Well, John.
Well, so the whole thing is so utterly and totally disturbing, but I want to go back to something you made brought to mind in your opening commentary about the other nonsense that people focus on, whether it's sports and other things. And not that life isn't a complex medley of interesting things, from sports to the arts to health and science and all kinds of things. And sometimes we need seriousness in our life and sometimes we need foolishness. But we live at very dangerous times. You don't have to be a historian. You don't have to be a rocket scientist. You don't have to be an extremely learned person. You basically have to have enough of your head out of the sand to actually turn on a TV or read a newspaper, say, once a month maybe, to at least understand that we live in very dangerous times. And one of the things that struck me during the speech and again during your comments is just how important and profoundly timely this is, and how many people really don't care, or they're just interested in politicizing it one way or another. But here's one of the things that struck me. When you look at some of the comments and you look up, for example, on Twitter, Netanyahu's speech is a hashtag that's really tremendous posing to people that are going on. And when you look at some of the vile, nasty, it's one thing to disagree with somebody politically, but when you listen to some of the amazing amount of not just anti-Semitism, not just anti-Bibi Netanyahu, not just anti-Israel, but anti-American, anti-West, I mean, it's just really, really disgusting. And here's one of the things that struck me. Look at people like Elie Wiesel, right? One of the, just an amazing man who's really, you have to say, is perhaps at the forefront of any living person today of understanding and trying to help the world to understand the importance of the Holocaust specifically and World War II in general with the mindset of never again, never again, never again. And his foundation, which is focused on basically intolerance and injustice through international dialogue and a lot of youth-focused programs. Do you know how many people follow Elie Wiesel on Twitter? And he's 5,448. Okay, now I know this is just one sampling, but let me just give you a comparison. Code Pink, a bunch of angry, nasty communist women who hate this country. This is not just left-right politics. I disagree with something. If you listen to what they say, they are vile. They are disgusting. And they hate this country with a passion. They are anti-Semitic. They are pro-terrorist. They are nauseating, disrespectful people. They have people following them. Brett? Kim Kardashian, who literally has zero talent and brings zero positive substance to the planet, okay? She basically is getting paid for existing. 29.6 million followers. even her bizarre, I decided now in middle age, I guess now that my, I'm past my blue pill prime, I'm going to be a woman. Bruce Jenner has over 36,000 people. But I go on, Justin Bieber, okay? He's got some talent, but I mean, you want to talk about just an obnoxious twit who's, really undeserving of civil society. 61 million followers. Whitney Houston, dead, self-destructive, died of an overdose, whatever. She still has 16,000 people, and you can go on and on. Let's look at Oscar Pistorius, okay? I mean, pretty much, hey, let's just fire some holes in my girlfriend because I'm having a bad day. Guess how many followers? 373,000. Why do I bring this up, Brett? Because it shows you that there is so many people are so foolishly looking at the most trivial things in life that's what they choose to pay attention to. Again, I understand life is difficult. We all work hard. We have family problems. We have health issues. We have a million things. But my God, women, men, wake up. This is your life, your country, your world, your faith, your value system. You need to find a little bit more time to pay attention to the things that are important. And that's exactly what Netanyahu was doing in his speech. He was trying to say, wake up and understand what's going on.
Now, John, you brought up Code Pink, and I have to tell you a story because I don't believe you were with me. I went into New York City on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. This country was attacked. Thousands of U.S. and foreign citizens were murdered, killed by those terrorists. And some of the most key people of government who were in the Bush administration, the Attorney General, the Press Secretary, Mukasey was there. What's his name? The Press Secretary. I'm drawing a blank. Anyway, you had a panel of like five Bush staffers. Ari Fleischer, thank you. I just couldn't think of his name. Anyway, they were all there, and they were discussing to a large crowd of people, by the way, in a private place. They were discussing the events on that day. It was not only historic, but it was a firsthand account, hearing from their very lips what the experience was like. They gave you details that you may have not had heard before. It was almost like you were in a history class, John. It was fascinating. Forget that you hate Bush. It was absolutely fascinating to have heard what those individuals had to say. And then in comes Code Pink, running down the aisles, throwing these pink flyers all up in the air, like harassing people, and every one of them was dragged out by their hair, probably. But they did everything they could to try to, at least for 10 minutes or so, interrupt what was an incredible history lesson. And I mention it because I started off the program talking about our history lessons and the failures. Code Pink, failure, absolute failure. I wonder where they learned their history, which communist university that is, John.
It's painful, Brett. It is really.
It was disgusting. It really was, and it was embarrassing for a lot of people there who weren't even political. They were there because they were New Yorkers. They were there because they had lost someone they loved, someone they cared about. Their city was attacked. Their country was attacked. It was personal, John. Did Code Pink get that? They don't care. They don't care.
Let's give a shout out to the Patriot Riders out there, especially to those Patriot Riders in our audience, because Patriot Riders are an amazing group of people. They've turned a weekend hobby, a love for motorcycles. Of course, they ride many different bikes, but many of these guys are guys who love to get out in the Harleys and enjoy the wind in their air and their hair, or what's left of it. In my case, under the. Enjoy the breeze, the rolling thunder of the Harley cruising down the highway, but to do something good with their time. And remember that the two things that they – well, there's probably three things that they spend the most time doing. One is helping to give a proper, respectful send-off and support the family of both fallen veterans and just old-timers who serve their country, and it's their turn to, spend eternity staring up at the sun. They also do a lot of charity work, but remember, one of the other things that they frequently do is when Code Pink or similar nauseating beings are going to show up to protest a funeral, remember, to literally harass a family burying their young son or their husband or their father or so forth who served this country.
Just like that crazy church,
Yeah, exactly. Any of these psychos, and it's people like the Patriot Riders who show up 100, 200 people to not just protest, but to actually create a human barrier to protect them. And I think that's great. I think it's absolutely amazing, and I love the fact that we're willing to do that. But, Brett, one of the things that's interesting to me, I've tried recently to do a little bit of debating with some folks in the social sphere. Yeah, I try to be polite, but first off, one of the things that bugs me is it's not that there are plenty of liberals out there who have well-structured opinions, who can make a good point, and who are respectful in dialogue. But what amazes me is how many people are out there who are just like the president. It's Bush's fault. If you literally said, I caught the president, with three dead bodies in his cooler, they would see, oh, yeah, well, Bush lied about going into Iraq. And you're like, stick with the point. And it just struck me. I had this one woman who has a TV show that we were kind of going back and forth a little bit because, of course, in her mind, Netanyahu is the biggest pariah in the world right now. All the risk, everything going on, the biggest risk to peace right now is the fact that Netanyahu wants to plead to Congress to please don't let Obama let a terrorist, the number one terrorist promoting nation, go nuclear. And it's just amazing. So we got into this debate, failures of Obama. And all of a sudden I realized it was about 5 minutes of showtime. And I thought, I better stop. But it's just going on and on from his meek, genuflection to former Russian president, about being flexible. 5 minutes later, of course, Putin laughs and attacks Ukraine. to his support for Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood, who, by the way, hate America, hate Israel and our way of life. Instead of supporting Morsi, on and on and on. You go down the line and you look at all these epic failures, and all I could say is probably one of the most positive things that I have seen repeated by many, many different people from across the land and from many other countries after listening to Netanyahu speak was, that's what a leader sounds like. Even if you don't agree with everything he says, that's what a leader sounds like. And he didn't even, and he didn't attack his enemies. He actually was, he had political enemies, He actually was being supportive, he was being praising and so forth, and he really stuck with the facts, relevance, and the contemporaneous dangers. By the way, all in all, I gave the speech high praise.
Yeah, John, our guest who's joining us, our Tuesday co-host, I suppose, James S. Robbins, has an article today in the USA Today, and he really got it done pretty quickly because I received it, shortly after the speech was done. But, he brought up some terrific points, and we'll discuss it with Jim. But one of the interesting things here is when you look at Iran, you're talking about a country that its president or its key leaders or whoever you want to point to all have Twitter accounts, all throughout various forms of the media, constantly make statements such as, we're going to destroy America, we're going to take down America, we're going to destroy Israel, we're going to kill the Jews, at what point do you say, when somebody makes a statement like that, maybe you should believe them? But they don't. I just don't understand how Obama could ignore what's actually being said. Anyway, without further ado, every Tuesday, we are honored to have our good friend, wonderful author and writer, and what a bright guy in these issues, but James S. Robbins joins us every Tuesday afternoon. He's here again today with a very timely, got it done very quickly, Jim, but your USA Today piece was really on point. You got it done very quickly after that speech. I was surprised to see it in my email so soon, but I'm glad that you wrote this and you brought up some wonderful points, but welcome as always.
Thanks. Yeah, it helps to be speedy, and I must say I'm a two-finger typist, so.
Let's go to the, it's not the most important point, but I enjoyed it. And you spoke of the gift that John Boehner gave to Benjamin Netanyahu, who, as you pointed out, this is his third speech to Congress, to a joint session. And he gave him a breast of Winston Churchill, a very historic and revered figure himself. And what's interesting to me about that particular gift is it wasn't too long after Barry Barack Hussein Satoru Obama took office that he returned breast of Churchill to that country it came from, you know, that Western imperial colonialist country that he despises so much. So I thought that was pretty funny. I enjoyed that piece. John Boehner moved up a rung on a ladder for me.
Yeah, that was one of the dreams of Obama's father, I guess, to, you know, kick out the colonial masters of Kenya, his, you know, biological father. But anyway, yeah, that aside, sure, Obama gives back the bust of Churchill, whereas John Boehner presents one to the Churchillian figure of our day, Benjamin Netanyahu. There's a lot of symbolism. And, of course, with this speech, it was his third one before Congress, and he ties the record for a foreign leader, which was set by Churchill.
Right. Okay. So now that we got the fun stuff out of the way, Netanyahu made some excellent and important points that draw correlation to past history, and he discussed these in your article. So please, if you could point out some of the warnings that we're being told by Benjamin Netanyahu, and will we heed them? Not you and I, but the guy occupying the White House.
Well, that's a good question. I think that in some respects, if I can agree with the president, who said there was nothing new in Mr. Netanyahu's speech. Yeah, there was, okay, maybe there was nothing new, but there was a lot of truth, which the president has seen fit to ignore. Particularly with respect to the nature of the Iranian regime, which is a revolutionary, theocratic regime with support for terrorism and aggression against its neighbors and human rights violations at home. I mean, it's a bad regime, and that was sort of the underpinning of everything that Mr. Netanyahu said. So you're starting off with that. This is the strategic perspective of Iran, a revolutionary Shiite Islamic Republic, expansionistic, hostile to Western freedoms. Okay, so now you're going to arm that country, which is already adventuristic, already supporting terror groups, militias, and other bad things around the world. Okay, so you hand them a nuclear weapon. Is that going to make them less expansionistic? Is that going to make them nicer people? No. But if you start with the premise that, oh, well, we'll just sign this deal with them and then hope that 10 years from now when they can do whatever they want, that in that 10-year period they will become nice people. No, that's unrealistic. I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous. So the only way to get around this is to deny them the capability to build nuclear weapons, to absolutely deny them that. And he addressed something that came up yesterday. It was Susan Rice who brought it up, that, well, we can't really deny the Iranians this capability because once you have the knowledge, then the genie's out of the bottle. And he said, yes, you can, and brought up salient examples, like if you have a NASCAR driver, I don't think he said NASCAR, but if you had a NASCAR driver who has all of the skills and the capabilities to be a champion driver, but he has no car, then it doesn't matter what capabilities he has. He doesn't have a car. So the fact that the Iranians know about nuclear technology is irrelevant if they don't have it. And any agreement that allows them to have the technology is absolutely going to fail because they will still have the intention to do what they want to do, and they will have the capacity to do it.
Well, Jim, I think you just gave the National Rifle Association the perfect debate against the new attempts that the administration is making against our Second Amendment rights, starting with munitions, right? Well, you know, once you know how to do it, then, you know, you're almost there. So what, you know, so what's the sense? But listen, I want to touch on a couple of things. First off, just a quick comment on the bust itself. I had seen some people make comments about, boy, that wasn't a particularly good-looking bust of Churchill. Now, first off, Churchill was not a great-looking man, okay? He wasn't known for his looks and charm. He was known for his stoic nature, his sobriety, and his dedication to principle and sober reflection of what was actually happening during his time. But where I thought it was actually a brilliant bust is it so showed the weight of the world on his shoulders, the reflection in his, captured in bronze. And by the way, that exact same image was captured in the eyes of Elie Wiesel when the camera panned to him. You know, he didn't look like a lot of the Obama, cronies and people that he likes to bring out when he's doing speeches. Okay, he bore the weight of the world on his shoulders, and it looks and it shows in his eyes because he understands, Jim, what you pointed out in your article in your reference to Churchill, saying that England, had to choose between war and shame. She has chosen shame and will get war. Elie Wiesel spent his entire life trying to make the point of never again, and he's there basically representing the fact that never again is happening again, and that's exactly the reason why Bibi Netanyahu was there in the first place, to bring awareness to the fact that it is happening again, and we have a Chamberlain at a time when we desperately need a Churchill.
Yes, Elie Wiesel is a living link between the time of the failure to heed Churchill's warning and the failure to take steps early against Hitler that led to what it led, and the current problems with Iran and the apparent failure of the Obama administration to understand what's going on, because they don't seem to. Susan Rice said yesterday at AIPAC that the no deal is better than a bad deal. But I am not convinced that the administration understands what a bad deal they have. And that, of course, was the theme of Mr. Netanyahu's speech today, was get a better deal. He wasn't saying don't have a deal, and he wasn't saying, oh, let's just go to war. He wasn't saying throw up our hands and do nothing. He was saying do it better. You're screwing up, so do it right. And, I mean, that's a very valid point. Now, back then, I mean, when Churchill said that that Chamberlain had a choice between shame and war and chose shame and we'll get war later, this is exactly the thing today that's happening. The administration's false dichotomy is you either take our deal, our crummy deal, or it's going to be a war. No, you take the crummy deal and you are guaranteeing conflict in the future. They have to understand that their dichotomy is wrong, and Mr. Netanyahu had it right. You take the bad deal, you're guaranteeing a problem.
I don't think there's any way of avoiding war at this point. I think it's just a matter of you'd rather go to war when your opponent has lesser capabilities with regards to the weapon systems they have. Iran is already controlling, they've got significant control over Syria, Iraq now, Yemen, name a couple other smaller countries there as well. And it's only a matter of time before they expand their sphere of influence into other countries as well. And then you throw in and we've discussed this with you even recently, the fact that an Iranian program that is now full scale, at some point in the near future, then leads to an escalation in some of the neighboring countries, specifically Saudi Arabia, maybe Turkey, Egypt. There will be others, but everyone out of fear will escalate. And so you're looking at not only a war, which is already occurring, but you're looking at a war that now you have people who may possess the weapons that you fear could be used ever again in the hands of those people who don't think rationally. And that is the problem. We've had enough of that in history. I mean, could you imagine, Jim, if Hitler or Stalin earlier on, or some of these other nut jobs in history had real, like today, nuclear bombs and the capability of delivering them, what the world would have been like.
Yeah, very different. And it's great that you brought those facts up. It was great that the Prime Minister brought up some of those facts, thing about the arms race that will be imminent in the Middle East should this happen, because the administration just doesn't want to talk about this. The great thing about the Netanyahu speech was its candor. He was laying it all out very explicitly what's going on. I saw this quote from Nancy Pelosi that she was weeping that he was somehow insulting the intelligence of America. Well, weepy Nancy better toughen up, because he was not insulting anyone's intelligence. It's the Obama administration that insults us by just handing us a bunch of bumper sticker talking points instead of the facts. When you look at things like the support for terrorism, look at things like this. Salient example. They have a military exercise with a mock-up of a U.S. aircraft carrier where the Iranian Navy's out there showing how to sink a U.S. aircraft carrier during negotiations with the United States. Wasn't that a little provocative to their negotiation partner to be undertaking this? You have the leader of Iran, the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, tweeting out that Israel should be destroyed during negotiations over nuclear weapons. Well, how are they going to destroy Israel then? Doesn't that kind of imply that they kind of want to have these weapons? And then all the other facts. People should, if they haven't heard the speech or read it, they should take a look, because he cataloged all of these things that the Iranians are doing. Not a long time ago, some of them, yes, but things that they're doing right now, as negotiations are ongoing, they're doing all of these things. Well, doesn't that show a little bit of bad faith? Doesn't that kind of prove the point that they can't be trusted? I would think so. But it's nothing that the administration wants to discuss or will ever discuss, because they are so afraid that the Iranians will walk out. Well, I love Netanyahu's answer to that, which is let them walk, because they will come back. They need the deal. They need it worse than we do. I mean, we need a deal, but they need it worse. And so let them walk, call their bluff, and then see what happens. That would be a tough negotiating strategy, not the, anything for a deal approach that we have right now.
So, Jim, do you suppose Nancy Pelosi cried when Obama using Yemen as a stand-up poster child for his incredible foreign policy, and then shortly after the Iranians topple Yemen? Do you suppose she cried that they now not only had a tourniquet if they need to apply it on the Strait of Hormuz, which, for those of you who aren't map experts, is the narrowest point that blocks the Persian Gulf and oil flows in and out, but the same with just off of Djibouti, for the Gulf of Aden, between that and the Red Sea, which means the Suez Canal. Do you think she cried when that happened? No, I don't think so. And that's exactly what he was trying to make the point of, is that there are predictable events. Look, Jim, I thought one of the things that he did a brilliant job of, there were many things about that speech, which I give maybe an A+, but let's definitely give it a solid A. One of the things I thought he did a brilliant job of was making it clear that we are dealing not with rational actors but ideologues, that time is not relevant. They are willing to be patient in time, that we've had nearly 40 years of this regime, and they are sticking to their plan, and their plan is winning. And so it's not just about a bad deal, but that time is also a critical part of this component, and we are losing the war on time, Jim. I thought that was a very important point to bring up.
Yeah, it is a really important point, and it underscores their commitment to their ideology, an ideology that is hostile to all of our values, American values, Western liberal values, values of Israel. He pointed that out. The administration never wants to point that out. But you got to take these people at their word. Someone like Prime Minister Netanyahu cannot afford not to when a country says, we're going to wipe you out. And as I point out in my piece, that was also part of the genius of Churchill. His genius was just listening to what the Nazis were saying and believing it. Because at the time, of course, people would say, that's just for internal consumption. He just says things like that to rile up the German people. That's all internal German politics. Don't worry about it. He just does what he needs to do. No, they said it, they meant it, and given the opportunity, they did it. So here you have the Iranians. They say what they mean. It's not for internal consumption. It's not to placate some kind of constituency group inside their country. If the supreme leader is tweeting out in English that countries need to be destroyed, as well as, you know, in Persian, then it's what they want. It's what they're going to do. So if you give them the means to do it, there's no reason to believe that they won't.
Jim, here's a question that I would have to the administration, but I'll give you the opportunity to answer it for them. If we use our NSA and other agencies to spy on the emails and communications of Americans and foreigners, to listen to the words that are being said or typed or written and take action, in other words, people get arrested all the time or looked into for the things that they say, then how come when the leaders of a specific country we're discussing right now, Iran, say they want to take down and destroy America, the same administration that oversees this operation ignores it? It's very inconsistent, and it's certainly, from a national security standpoint, very foolish.
Right, because they don't take it seriously. Because they're so sophisticated that they, you know, things like that, oh, they just, you know, it's just all part of their politics. They don't really mean those things. And seriously, they don't believe it. You know, during the Cold War, there were a lot of people who didn't take the statements from the Communist Party very seriously about world revolution. It was only until after the wall came down and the Politburo archives were opened up that they found out, hey, guess what? They really believed all that junk that they were saying. You know, it wasn't, you know, we'll be sophisticated and not listen. Well, you don't gain anything by not listening. They don't say it for no reason.
And by the way, an opposition leader in Russia was just assassinated. Sorry, I just wanted to throw that out there as you mentioned
it. Yeah, Putin takes it seriously. He was listening, you know. You oppose me, okay, I'll whack you.
The whole thing is sort of laughable. Jim, I give the speech very high praise. I thank all the Democrats, 75% of whom roughly had the responsibility, even if they did so pinching their nose, some of them, you know, and only a few I noticed were, like Pelosi, were overtly disrespectful, but I think they, you know, the fact that they showed up was very important. I wanted to actually focus on three things that I thought were, I don't know if I'd say glaring omissions, but let's just say there were three missed opportunities. One, I think he could have done himself a great justice by pointing out, he pointed a threat to the American people, but he could have, and I'll mention all three and then I'd love to get your commentary. One, he should have pointed out the fact that the Iranians are already creating havoc in our own hemisphere. He could have talked about what's been going on with Kirchner and Argentina and the Iranian connection there, Venezuela and how close bases, Iranian bases that easily could lob missiles to Miami, and other things, Cuba, etc. That's one. Number two, I think he could have done a better job of pointing out the risk of focusing just on centrifuges and not also focusing on all the other weapon systems. He spoke a little bit about three-stage rockets being able to reach anywhere in the U.S., but he could have time talking about that they're building taking every single step that you would want to take from an offensive and defensive position to wage war. And the third thing I think he could have pointed out was the fact that we also have to be focusing 100% on intent, because even if we do everything right, how easy is it for them to work with their partner, cash-starved North Korea, to buy a couple of ready-made nukes the minute their three-stage delivery system, intercontinental ballistic rockets, and appropriate airplanes, ships, defensive mechanisms, and so are in place? Or a nuclear sub, which doesn't necessarily have to launch a missile successfully. It just has to get it up out of the water somehow to create amazing devastation off the coast anywhere in the U.S.
Well, I agree with you. He could have made more of those points. He did touch on each of those and could have gone into more detail on them. But, you know, he has limited time and people might glaze over. Furthermore, those aren't part of the negotiations. And I know that your point is, wait, it should be part of the debate, even if it's not part of the negotiations, because the Iranians have yes, they've taken steps to weaponize. It's not just that they're working on the warhead itself or working on the nuclear weapon itself, but they're working on making how to make warheads out of the nuclear weapons, how to attach them to missiles. And yes, they can launch satellites into orbit. They already have multi-stage rockets that could potentially reach the United States if they had the right guidance system. And for all we know, they're working on that too. So yes, from top to bottom, the Iranians are working on offensive systems. We are focused on the very narrow thing in this negotiation, you know, looking for a really bad deal that will not touch any of this other stuff that they're doing. And if we sign a deal and then say, okay, sanctions are off, inspections are off, and what have you, and just let you go on your merry way, they're going to get there much sooner under the framework of this deal than they would without it.
Yeah, I agree with you. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if they have more than what we are aware of. They probably have facilities that they've worked on, which are being used that we don't know of yet. For many years, they've been avoiding or not cooperating or outright lying to the international inspectors for the various agencies.
That are,
sorry about that.
Well, as Robert Falzgraf said, we never detected a successful Soviet disinformation operation. You know, or we never detected a successful Soviet deception, and the same is true of Iran.
Right. Yeah, sorry about that little background. Anyway, we're short on time, John. But, Jim, it's always a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much, and I appreciate your article in the USA Today. I think you've been doing one almost every week now. An opinion piece. So, of course, folks, go out to USA Today or online and find a copy of his opinion piece. Do you have anything else coming out this week?
I'll probably do something for U.S. News, but for now, yeah, USA Today opinion is where to go.
Well, thank you as always, and we'll speak again with you next week, every Tuesday, James S. Robbins. Go find him on Twitter and Facebook and follow him, and, of course, pick up his most recent book, The Real Custer. All right, take care, Jim.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, John, we've got about a minute left. I wanted to make one comment, and I'll let you jump in here. I made mention of the assassination of a murdered politician, Boris Nemtsov, who was the very outspoken. I want to say, I think he was about 54, 55, 56, somewhere around there, so he wasn't very old, very active fellow. And I was actually first made aware of this, by the way, because he is friends with our family, my wife's family, of course. But there's a relationship there with the family, and they were very sad at that news. And it's actually a very sad thing that this administration will never speak to, I'm sure. And it's very frightening when the opposition in countries that you have concerns with are being killed. How about Iran? What happened with the opposition there, John?
Well, you know exactly what happened. The opposition Iran, he left hanging. That's exactly what he did. You know, I want to say one quick thing before you close out, Brett, is some of the Democrats are now ripping Netanyahu, basically saying that his discussion on the Iran new deal is fear-mongering. I think this is ironic that the same people who are telling us the ocean's rising by tiny fractions is going to absolutely destroy life and destroy the planet seem to not be worried about nukes. Unbelievable.
It is, John. Anyway, I can't believe, I guess we're almost at the end of the show again. Anyway, always thankful to James, Jim Robbins, for joining us. I was thankful for you listening in. We'll be back again tomorrow. By the way, great guests this week. Ambassador Rooney and Phil Kirkman joining us later in the program. See you again tomorrow. Have a great afternoon. That's a wrap.
The Final Say Radio Show is an original broadcast of Rappaport Media. To hear more The Final Say podcast, go to www.thefinalsay.com.